What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, special operations military news, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Soft Rep Radio. Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. You're on the air today with Steve Balistrieri. I'm your host today. We have a very special guest with us, Joe Kent. Joe is a former Army Ranger. He was in the 2nd Ranger Battalion, part of the Ranger Regiment. He then joined Special Forces. I believe he was in the 5th Special Forces Group. He did 11 deployments in combat. He ended up retiring as a chief warrant officer out of the U.S. Army. He was also, for a special forces guy, which is rare, he's a gold star husband. His wife, Shannon Kent, was the U.S. Navy's intelligence operative who was killed in Syria a few years ago. I'm sure most of our listeners are well aware of that. So we're going to talk to Joe about all of that, but before we go any further, we want to welcome him to the podcast. Joe, thank you for taking the time this afternoon, and welcome to Soft Rep Radio. By the way, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thanks for having me on. Been listening to you guys for quite a while now, so pretty cool to be actually on the podcast.
Well, we're very glad to have you, sir. So, you know, fill in our listeners about how you came to be in the military, and, you know, you can put in some of the highlights. I don't know if anything's classified you that you can't talk about, but just fill us in briefly on that and we'll go from there.
Sure. Yeah. I pretty much got to live out my, you know, childhood dreams as far back as I can remember, I wanted to be a military guy, commando of some sort. So, you know, growing up in the 90s, there wasn't a ton of information on that type of thing other than watching the A-Team and G.I. Joes. You know, as I got a little bit older, though, I started doing some research, and the 1993 Black Hawk Down incident happened. Like as I was kind of becoming a young man, going into high school and having to get serious about what I wanted to do. So that kind of made me aware of the Ranger Regiment. Before that, I had been interested in Special Forces, but I didn't really know like how that whole thing happens, like how you go from being in the military to trying out the Special Forces. And then as I did some more research and talked to, annoyed some recruiters probably because I was like 13 or 14 and asking them questions. And they're like, kid, you can't join, just leave me alone. But I eventually figured out that, hey, you could go right into the Ranger Regiment if you played your cards right. So graduated high school. My parents helped me negotiate a Ranger indoctrination program contract with my recruiter. So from there, I went to RIP and somehow made it through all that and ended up at 2nd Ranger Battalion in 1998. And that was just a great place to grow up. Highly disciplined, very combat focused, even though it was a very peacetime military. We had guys that had jumped into Panama, Grenada, and even a few guys that were veterans from 3rd Ranger Battalion's experience in Somalia. So great. I can't say enough good things about growing up there. Decided to make my way to Special Forces in September of 2001. So a big highlight was my second or third day of SFAS. They like put us in the big classroom there at Camp McCall and told us that like America was under attack. And I was an E4 and like knew everything. So I kind of thought like, there's a scenario for SFAS. Like I thought it was all kind of like a game or something, you know, cause you know, you go to different schools and they always give you some scenario. I thought that's what that was, and until later on the day when they were like, hey, if you're from New York or you're from DC or you have family there, like, we're going to open up all the offices that have phones that you can use the pay phones to call your families. And that's when I was like, oh, wow, this is crazy.
It's funny because SFAS, I used to work there. I was one of the instructors. Yeah. Yeah, and it's one big mind fuck. So I'm sure, you know, the second day there, you're thinking, okay, yeah, these guys, they just want to see how we're going to react to this. I mean,
that's what I thought. Yeah. That's so amazing. I mean, they told us throughout that day and the next day that, hey, this is no bullshit. And you know, I hadn't been around that long, but I could see that the demeanor the instructors had from when they picked us up to when they told us about the attacks had drastically changed. And anytime they talked about the attacks, they were like, hey, guys, this is totally real. And the whole world's changing. And by the time you get out of here, whether you make it or not, you're probably going to war. And this is our country will never be the same. So I you know, just kind of took all that in as a candidate and somehow got through SFAS, and sure enough got out on the other end, and you know, the world had changed. So from there I went to the Q course and finally got to fifth group in summer of 2003. So I missed that, the initial push into Afghanistan. Second battalion got kind of left out a little bit, third battalion got to jump in, and then I was in language school, Pashto language school, when we pushed into Iraq. And so, you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s, I was like, well, I just missed the two wars of my generation. So I you know, it's funny to say now, because I was like, man, I think we missed it. But by the time I got to fifth group, all the guys there that have been around the block, they were like, no, this is just starting, man. We're actually gearing up and we're going right back over. There's an insurgency brewing. I don't know exactly how fifth group understood that. They just understood the ground level, I think, to know that we were in for a long fight. So sure enough, by late August, September, I was back. I was in Iraq for the first time, and that kind of started a cycle of consistent Iraq deployments for the next 10 years. Got a little break and did some other stuff in Yemen and the Horn of Africa. But Iraq was fifth group's baby for the Iraq war proper, and then again in OIR. So that's where I spent the vast majority of my career. Going in and out of fifth group.
Yeah, I heard Yemen probably rivals Niger as one of the two worst places to be.
Yeah, I was there at a really interesting time. I was there in 2010, 2011, and so we were going after a very real Al Qaeda threat, but there was also the Houthi insurgency that the old government of Yemen was very worried about, and they were actively fighting. And then the Arab Spring broke out while we were there. And so we were there for the beginning of the revolution. We didn't quite realize what was going to happen. Saleh hadn't flipped to the Houthis yet, but it was just, it was a neat experience as a Green Beret because we were, it wasn't a total war zone yet. So we weren't as restricted as we were in Iraq to living on like a military outpost or whatever. We had a team house in the city and we kind of had freedom of movement. We were training some guys that were out there getting after it in combat. And then we were also trying to figure out, you know, what the hell was going on in the country. So it was, That was quite the learning experience for me.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I know Yemen really heated up, obviously, afterwards, and it's still not really a safe place right now. But, yeah, then, you know, what year did you become a warrant?
I became a warrant in 2009. So my Yemen trip in 2010 was my first trip as a WO1. So,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I became a warrant in 89, just before everything that Panama started. They had to the Army's eternal regret, they made me an officer. So, you know, you know that
that's the way I always felt.
You know, you can take the boy out of Boston, but you can't take the Boston out of the boy. So, you know, I wasn't, I guess, the epitome of, you know, officer and gentleman and stuff. When the colonel would have his hail and farewells or whatever at and the get togethers at his house, I'd ride my Harley over there, which always got a frown. So
I was being a warrant officer when if you ever got reminded that you're also an officer, it was like when your parents called you by your full name, like you were in trouble. Like, hey, you guys are officers now. I was like, oh yeah, man, that's right.
My parents came to our graduation. At that time, they really didn't even have a designated warrant course. They just had to like kind of, we were lumped in with the captains, you know.
Oh, really?
For the attachment officer. They really didn't know what to do with us. I mean, I'm kind of dating myself back then. But yeah, we were lumped in with the captains. So, you know, we just kind of made it our goal to, you know, give the captains the benefit of our experience up to that point and, you know, help them become better team leaders. So I think it kind of worked out, but
yeah, that's actually a pretty cool model, I think.
Yeah. When we graduated, we had a bunch of foreign officers in there and I had befriended a couple of guys actually from the Middle East. There was a Jordanian SF officer and there was a guy from Indonesia and my parents came and, so these two guys come over and they're just like jumping all over my dad. They're giving him a hard time about me. They're like, your son is such a rude bastard, right? My father was rolling. He just couldn't stop laughing. And he was like, well, obviously you got to know him really well. So
that's good, man. Cross cultural communication.
That's it. Yeah. We definitely had a good group. So I have no complaints, but it was pretty interesting. So we were from different eras, obviously, because when you went through SFAS, I was already out so by that time. But
yeah, I think it kind of never changes, though. The you know, some details here and there do, and some lingo does, but I think it all usually seems like the same experience to me.
Yeah, it was you know, it was really difficult for us because when the guys that in my era went through the Q course, we didn't have a selection course. You know, it was straight into phase one, and they had the, back then there was a lot of harassment stuff, you know. But when they started selection, obviously it was brand new. So the instructors, when we got there, you know, I had already been to O&I, and, you know, so I'm like, oh, I want to go to O&I. I want to be on the O&I committee. And they said, no, we need guys out of selection. So I'm like, oh, man, Camp McCall. So I get out there, and then that's when the major broke the bad news. And he's like, well, before you can work here, you have to go through selection.
Oh, no way. Like,
yeah. So all of us, we were looking at each other like, well, we're already qualified. And he's like, yeah, that's okay. So I'm like, oh, man, this shit really sucks.
Man,
so, you know, when you're doing all that stuff, it's one thing when you're a candidate. It's another thing. And the candidates who are there, again, they think it's part of the mind fuck because they're like, these guys got tabs. And they don't have numbers on because we didn't have to wear a number or anything. like those, you know, little white tag numbers and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're looking at us like, you know, they just kept staring at us. Now they kept us, we would have our own team when we do team events or whatever, but you know, we had to do all the same stuff they were doing. And finally one day when we were doing the land nav course, we were all in the truck sitting together. And finally, one of the kids said, can I ask you a question? Sure. Go ahead. What the fuck are you guys doing here? And we said, hey, what do you mean? He's like, well, you guys already have tabs. And my buddy Brian, look, he's passed away now. Brian was like, oh, well, we're going through training for NASA. And whoever excels the best in the next 18 months gets to fly on the next shuttle mission. So these guys were all like, wow, that's pretty cool.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it never changes. So SFAS is really, really good, though. I'm a firm believer in it. I think it does a great job for what it's designed for, and you know, hopefully it'll never change.
Yeah, I think there's always people talking about what changes and how big of a crisis it is, but I mean, it seems like we do a pretty good job of, you know, having a standard and looking for a certain kind of person. So yeah, it's definitely a good process.
Right. And we're going to transition to your later military career in here in just a second. I just need to read an ad from one of our sponsors. Hey, everyone. While it's no secret that big tech companies are tracking and listening to everything we do these days, did you know that active duty military and veterans are even more likely to be targeted by scams, predatory ads, and data thieves? Wondering how you can prevent them from tracking you and others from listening to your private conversations and manipulating your thoughts, your family's actions, and even your own votes? Fight back with Winston Privacy and defend yourself against the enemies who will take advantage of your military service and steal your personal information for their illicit gain. So fight back against big tech and spying. Get $20 off today with our exclusive promo. Just go to winstonprivacy.com/softrep. That's winstonprivacy.com/softrep, or use the coupon code softrep20. All right, we're back to our podcast. We're talking with Joe Ken. We were doing some lighthearted stuff, crazy selection stories. But I want to transition over to your wife's story. And how did you guys meet?
Yes, we met in some military training. So after 2011, when Fifth Group when the U.S. government pulled out of Iraq, and that part of the war kind of came to an end, mm-hmm. I was at a kind of juncture in my career, and so I tried out for a special operations unit that kind of combines special operators and intelligence folks. And I'm kind of talking around it, but I'm sure you guys can all
the general
gist. So, anyways, my wife Shannon and I had met once briefly before in Iraq in 2007, but lost touch of each other. I actually had a real brief meeting at a targeting meeting about how we're going to go find some bad guys. So I didn't see her again for another 6 years or so. And then we both end up at this parking lot one morning where you're supposed to report to this training. It's kind of the same pattern. After you get selected for this unit, you had to report for about a year worth of training. So day one, I'm there, and I run back into Shannon. And so we kind of, as busy as we both were in that next year or so, we started dating, and a year later we were married. So we kind of connected common bonds of, you know, being kind of living a life dedicated to deploying, and, you know, just the chaos of like the mid to late 2000s, and then kind of bonded in the stress of being in a pretty intensive course.
Oh, absolutely. Now, did you guys deploy together?
So we were both in Iraq in 2007 together. She was working at like the task force level as a targeter and an analyst, and then I was on an ODA. And so we actually spoke briefly once, and you know, after that we actually didn't see each other again or talk, because she moved to a different location right after that. So that was the only actual deployment that we did together, because after that we started having kids, and so we'd kind of switch back and forth between who was with the kids and who would deploy.
Yeah, and you had, what, two sons, right?
Yep, we have two
Colton and Joshua?
Yep, Colt and Josh.
Now, how old are they now?
They are 5 and 3.
Wow, they're still very young.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I know that, you know, obviously when everything happened in Syria, I was reading about your wife, and she was considered basically like a rock star in the, you know, the intelligence operators, that realm of the world, and our, I guess, joint special operations people. And I was surprised to learn that not only did she speak fluent Arabic, but she spoke fluent Spanish and French and Portuguese as well.
Yeah, she's just one of those people, like a true polyglot. She had a love of languages. So she learned Spanish from working in the stables up in upstate New York when she was a kid. Just speaking of stable hands, who were, a lot of them were from Argentina, because there's a huge polo and equestrian community down there. So that's where she learned Spanish. And then from there, when she was in high school, like her high school French class was going to go to Paris, and I guess if she scored high enough on a test that she could act as a translator, she got to go for free. So she buckled down and learned French real fast, as she did. And then from there, once 9/11 happened, she was a couple years younger than me. She had just started college, but her father and her uncle were both first responders to 9/11. Her uncle's a Staten Island firefighter, and then her father's a New York State trooper. So she had looked at the military before, but, you know, pre 9/11, I think there wasn't a huge call to service for a lot of folks, but 9/11 happened. You know, Shannon's uncle and father responded, and then Shannon and her brother, who's a year younger, both went and promptly enlisted in the military. And Shannon knew right away that she wanted to learn Arabic. She knew she could do it. So she just went and hit up all the recruiters. And the first one that said, yeah, I can send you down to Defense Language Institute to learn Arabic was the Navy. So that was her. People always ask her how she ended up in the Navy. And she was like, well, everybody else wanted me to like learn Chinese or try this MOS or that MOS. And the Navy said, yeah, we'll give you what you want right off. So she ended up joining the Navy right after 9/11 and heading off to begin her, I'd say, like, lifelong learning experience with immersing in what's a very, very difficult language.
That's that's a pretty amazing stuff. And I know, you know, for a woman back in 2008, being deployed with the SEAL team, I mean, that, you know, she had to know her stuff to get the respect of those guys, because they're just like SF guys. I mean, you know how it is. I mean, if there's a woman there, you're going to automatically wonder if she can hold her own. Obviously, Shannon could. From everything I've read about her, she could hold her own against anyone.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, there's always been women in special operations, you know, going back to the OSS. Mm-hmm. But there was I think when the global war on terror kicked off, we, you know, women weren't allowed to be in frontline positions. But then where was the front line, especially in a place like Iraq where we were getting hit so heavily, doing logistics, or our bases were being attacked. So the front line was kind of like, you know, something that just didn't exist. But Shannon kind of found her way to working with special operations, you know, based off of a need that the units all had. So Shannon started out just doing signals intelligence and translation, and she just kept volunteering every time they needed someone to go and get closer to the fight. So she kind of found herself working at the task force level. This is at a time where I think, other than SF guys, other than Green Berets, most of the task forces weren't really looking at engaging with the Iraqis as much, either as a partner force or looking for sources of intelligence. So I think around 06, 07, the bigger soft community really started looking at that. And Shannon was right place, right time, but with the right attitude and the right skills. So she identified that, hey, there's a gap and we need to go talk to some of these Iraqis. And she had no problem doing it. And then some SEAL commanders who also realized that, hey, we can get more bad guys if we exploit this. They took the initiative and kind of put her down at the task force level, at the strike force level with SEAL platoons to go and start working with local Iraqis, to develop actionable intelligence. So she was working way outside of her scope as a cryptological or SIGINT technician. And that's kind of how she got her foot in the door from there. And that was 07. From there, the SEAL team started forming their own intelligence teams that were ran by SEALs. and they invited her to come to tryouts for that. So she was in the first or second class. There was two that kind of happened a couple weeks apart from each other that allowed females to come try out. So she was in the first crop of women that were allowed into the SEAL platoons. Before that, the SEAL platoons had been completely closed off to anybody who wasn't a SEAL.
That's pretty that's pretty telling for how good she was. And you know, it's one of the things that struck me when reading about her story was that she could have been a doctorate psychology student. And I guess because she had a previous, I guess, cancer diagnosis, was it thyroid cancer? They turned her down for that. And that's how she ended up on her final deployment.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Shannon, once we started having kids and, you know, we were getting a little bit older and you know, had a young family, Shannon was like, decided that she wanted to do something that would let her stay home with the kids, but still contribute to the community. So with her language skills and her desire to like help out veterans, rewinding a little bit, her last deployment in Afghanistan, she was assigned to a SEAL team where the SEAL team commander actually killed himself on the deployment. They had suffered some losses, and this guy, for whatever reason or another, tragically took his own life. And Shannon had always had an interest in psychology, but after that one, she was like, you know, someday, whenever I, you know, get off the ride at deployments, I'd like to do something that I can help veterans with this suicide, you know, epidemic that we have right now. So as we grew our family, Shannon was like, I think I'm going to really focus on my education and apply for this program. So she got her master's, her bachelor's and her master's all on her own at night, doing night school and online college. And then she applied for, took the GRE and was accepted to the military's medical program, which is one of the better deals in the world if you can get it. They pay for your PhD and your med school, and they commission you as an officer. And that's where she hit a stumbling point. So she academically got accepted into this course. But the first step is sort of like going warrant. The first thing they do is they put you through the OCS to make you an officer, mm-hmm. which means you're subjected to, and this is like a real big catch 22 bureaucratic thing. They subject you to accession standards. So you're like a person that just came off the street into the military, as opposed to retention standards. So retention standards, the military understands that you've been banged up and beaten up a little bit more. And so they give you some more leeway if you can still do your job. So Shannon at this point had been in for close to 15 years. And so she had had thyroid cancer while I was on a deployment. She had it, she was diagnosed with it. She had it cut out of her thyroid and was back to work within, I think, less than a week. Wow. It was barely even a blip on the radar, and she was cancer free. So, it really wasn't a huge deal to her. It was a big deal, but it wasn't a big deal to her, and it wasn't a big deal medically, but it was in her medical records, which if you've had cancer, you can't go enlist or join the military. So they refused to commission her, which made her ineligible for the medical program. So, she was still working, you know, in the at the NSA in special operations, and so it was her turn to deploy essentially, because she hadn't gotten into that PhD program. But I mean, she was, you know, it's obviously had she gotten into that program, she'd still be alive today. But she, you know, knew that deploying was, you know, what the military paid her to do, what she had spent, you know, her adult life working towards, and that was where her skill set was needed, because ISIS was in its final, ISIS's territorial caliphate was kind of its final stand. So she, you know, was torn about leaving us and disappointed that she had kind of gotten bureaucratically tripped up. But, you know, she, just like all of us who go and fight for our country, she, you know, eagerly went out to go do her part.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Yeah, and, you know, it's got to be tough, especially for a mother, regardless of what her job is, to leave home two young boys like that. I mean,
it tore her up. That was the big reason why she wanted to do the psych program, was to be able to stay home and focus on the boys. You know, as much as I was like, you know, you shouldn't go because you're a mother, she was like, well, that argument's bullshit because men have been deploying for as long as we've had wars away from their wives and their children. Like, if I want to be treated like one of the guys, why would this incident or why would this circumstance be any different, you know, which I couldn't argue with as much as I wanted to. So that was kind of where she stood. She was like, I don't like it. I don't want to do it. But at the same time, like, I'm not gonna, you know, try and find a way out of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, was it a whole team of her coworkers that went into that restaurant in Syria that were, you know, killed in that suicide bombing?
Yeah, it was a mixed team of you know, special operations guys that were out there that day. They were just outside the restaurant, doing some work trying to run down the last remnants of ISIS there in Mandij.
Was it ISIS operative who did that?
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it was an ISIS suicide bomber. ISIS took credit for it.
Now, then, was that about the time you retired?
So I retired in 2018.
Retired by then.
I was. Yeah, I'd moved on. I was working in the intelligence community. So my retirement wasn't much of a retirement, really, which is kind of why Shannon wanted to switch over to the psych world and kind of stay more at home, because I had kind of gotten a job where I would have been on the road a little bit. So she was having to not only take care of the kids, but she was having to, you know, be flexible for my schedule as well. So
Understood. So I wanted to switch gears. I know that, you've written some stuff, and it has nothing to do with the passing of your wife. It's just from your experience and with 11 combat deployments, I think you have plenty of experience, and you wrote some stuff about, it's time to get out of these endless wars in the Middle East. And I'd like for you to share some of your thoughts on that, because I think, our listeners will definitely understand where you're coming from. And I think you'll maybe change some opinions on people who think we shouldn't leave.
Yeah, absolutely. Once Shannon was killed, I didn't actually plan on speaking out too much or being public. I wanted to tell her story. But I had a pretty unique opportunity because Shannon was killed right after Trump tried to get us out of Syria the first time, which led to General Mattis or Secretary Mattis at the time resigning, and then the head of the ISIS, the counter ISIS coalition, Britt McGurk, resigning, and then a lot of other lower level bureaucrats generally resisting what the president had just put out. So it was kind of a polarizing moment that I think a lot of people mischaracterized as Trump being reckless and Trump doing something wrong. We were at a point in the counter-ISIS fight come, I'd say, the winter of 2018, where the territorial caliphate was, for the most part, defeated. And there was two competing narratives. You know, one was what President Trump was saying, was, hey, we're going to smash all the ground they're holding, and they're not going to be able to hold ground, and then we're getting out, and we're not getting stuck. And then there's the prevailing narrative of the global war on terrorism, which has been, this is a long fight and we have to stay forever. Wherever there's radical Islamic extremism, we need to have boots on the ground, and we need to stay and have consistent engagements. And that's something that I think we've all believed for a while, and we tried and we've tried for quite a while. And if it was going to be successful, I think Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria would look a heck of a lot different, which is a stark contrast to some other places where we've had very distinct threats from radical Islamic terror, specifically targeting our homeland, mostly from the Horn of Africa and Yemen, and also in Pakistan. And those are some places where we haven't had a ton of persistent ground engagement. We've had some smaller bases in neighboring countries, and we've done targeted counterterrorism raids and targeted counterterrorism operations with drone strikes and intelligence operations with partner forces. And that's kind of kept the homeland safe. Whereas if you contrast that with the trillions of dollars and almost 7,000 lives now we've poured into Iraq and Afghanistan, I think the differences couldn't be more stark. And if we look at how we initially got into these wars after 9/11, we obviously pursued Al-Qaeda into Afghanistan with the intent of getting the perpetrators of 9/11 and also the Taliban that gave them safe haven. We did that. We overthrew the Taliban government. We chased Al-Qaeda into Pakistan by the winter of 2001, winter of 2002. And then we stopped. And then George Bush publicly said, hey, I changed my mind, and we are going to do the ultimate nation building. We're going to bring peace and stability to this region, which is overall going to eventually make us more safe and secure. A huge ideological gamble with our lives and with our fortunes. And so ever since then, despite the rhetoric of different politicians, that's been what we've been doing in Iraq. And I say Iraq and Afghanistan, it's morphed a little bit into Syria because of the ISIS fight as well. But everything we've done has been centered on building up these governments that don't really naturally exist. I mean, there's been different iterations of the Afghan government, but Afghanistan's a bunch of tribes.
Tribes, yeah.
And then Iraq has had different strongmen. There's a huge ethno-sectarian war that's raging there. So everything that we're trying to do with building these centralized governments that just become pits for money and resources and lives, it just hasn't been effective. I'm not against us having limited engagements. I think we'll have small teams of special operations and intelligence people throughout the world, probably for the rest of our history, because that's just the nature of conflict and nature of war. But nowadays, if you stay too long in these locations, you get bogged down. And I think you can track the the rise of some of our adversaries that we thought were a thing of the past at the end of the Cold War, like Russia, and we were completely blindsided by China, while we've been bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan, having the most mighty military in the whole world, learn tribal dynamics of Afghanistan and Pakistan and Anbar Province, Iraq, really strategic flyover country, if you think about it. We've had China eat our lunch economically, maneuver on our flank in the Pacific. We've had Russia reemerge and threaten Europe. And meanwhile, we have politicians that think we need to keep our military focused and bogged down in these locations. So I think it's just time for us to start really rethinking the way that our nation fights wars and uses power. And I think our wars in the Middle East reached diminishing returns probably a decade ago. So I think it's time to kind of cold turkey and just get out of both of those locations for a wide variety of reasons.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because a lot of what you said about Afghanistan, I don't know if you know are familiar with Bing West, who was former Marine officer, and he was the Undersecretary of Defense for, I think, international security in the Reagan administration. I spoke with him earlier this week, and you know, he pretty much said almost word for word a lot of what you're saying about Afghanistan. I mean, you know, we're trying to build a nation of tribes who don't want a nation. They want a ninth century caliphate. So I don't know what the end game is going to be there. But that peace agreement we signed with them back in February, it doesn't seem like.
I think that the peace agreement and all that's just kind of eyewash to give us a reason to say that we're going to leave, which is fine. Like, I'm not against it. It also gives us another reason that, like, hey, I mean, I'm of the mindset places like Afghanistan, and this goes for probably a lot of the Middle East and the Islamic world, like, hey, we don't care really what you do or how you live. That's not our business. However, if you harbor terrorists, we will come back in here and we will crush you. So something like the peace agreement to actually have it in writing, and if they do get bold enough to let anybody with any kind of external aspirations come back in there, we can say, well, they violated the peace agreement, and now we're going to inflict some kind of punitive damage against them, but then get back out. We're not there to build a government and train a military and open little girl schools. Like, if we come back here, it's to ruin your day.
Yeah. And that was something you had written for Fox News. You know, most people believe that there's only two choices when we're talking about the Middle East.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
We have to either fight and stay until we have total victory, or we have to pull out and, you know, go into a shell. And that's not really the way. I mean, there's other ways to, you know, for us to conduct that. And I think you hit the nail on the head. And I think that's probably what's going to happen in the future. I think we're not going to probably pull out completely. We'll probably leave some special operators and, you know, intel people with the capability of directing airstrikes if these terrorists, which I believe in Afghanistan, the Taliban hasn't even divested themselves of Al Qaeda. So
I think the Taliban that hangs out in Qatar and has meetings with us, I think they say they do, but I think the guys on the ground don't. But I mean, that's another thing that I think folks just don't understand about the region is you have competing tribes, competing ethno-sectarian groups. They're all kind of at each other's throats. If we utilize our intelligence services to monitor that, we can more or less play them off of each other, because when they're busy fighting each other, they really can't provide sanctuary for folks that want to come and attack us. And so if the Taliban, as nebulous as the Taliban is and non-monolithic as it is, if they know that there's a financial incentive to ratting on their cousins who are letting Al-Qaeda guys come back in, well, then our intelligence guys are going to stay pretty busy, and so are our drones. I mean, we don't need to have a massive base there doing these huge, you know, government building type of missions there. As a matter of fact, the lower our footprint is, the less vulnerable we are, because, you know, we saw the whole controversy with Russian bounties. That's a whole different topic, but really anywhere that we overextend ourselves in an overt presence, we're the biggest dogs on the planet. We make ourselves at that point a target for everybody to come and provide money to an economy full of people who are essentially paid proxies or paid terrorists, however you want to look at it. Because that's kind of the way a lot of these tribes work. They have a well-armed cadre of young men who know how to fight. And if you pay them, they're happy to go fight you. So if we have these big bases in Iraq or Afghanistan, all of our enemies can leverage that against us, which is how you want to fight us. You fight us unconventionally. None of our adversaries want to fight us head on. So we take away a ton of our technological advantage when we go and we stay in these places permanently and we get within small arms fire range of these dudes. I mean, we're going to need some people within small arms range fire every now and again, but for the most part, we can use intelligence and we can use our standoff and our allies in the region to get the job of counterterrorism done.
Yeah, and you know, going to Iraq, you know, one of the interesting things about Iraq is they fought a hugely costly war with Iran back in the 80s, and they, right. You know, that was their enemy. I mean, that was their, you know, dyed-in-the-wool enemy. They couldn't stand each other. And then after, you know, our invasion of Iraq the second time, it seems like now the Iranians have basically the government at their beck and call in Iraq, and they have a lot more influence. And, you know, it comes down to, I believe, and I'm sure you feel the same way, that it's time for us to pull out of Iraq. And it's up to the Iraqis to decide whether or not, you know, they're going to be allies with us in the Western world, or they're going to be allies with Iran, who's still a pariah on the national community.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there's a huge history there on why Iran was able to get their tentacles in there. Mostly it's just because the population is mostly Shia. Saddam treated the Shias horribly, and Iran did a really good long game of outreach to the Shia community there. And we were, I think, willingly blindsided by that going into Iraq the second time, and we put a ton of Shias and the Shia militant groups that had very close ties to Iran. We put them in power because they were the alternative to Saddam. And nobody really wanted to admit how bad we messed up, because there's two administrations there that have that yoke on their face, mostly Bush. But the table's been set that this Iraqi government that we built is supposed to be some sort of a success, especially after we said so in 2011 when we pulled out the first time. So now we have this Iraqi government that is more loyal to Iran, who's our enemy, who we fund. We also provide a good deal of economic waivers to Iraq so they can do business with Iran. So Iran accesses the world community through Iraq that we fund. However, the Iranians, anytime that they're upset with something that we do sanctions-wise, they again have within close reach of their most lethal asset, their proxies, they have a huge U.S. embassy and they have multiple U.S. bases. So that when we came back in there in 2014, 2015 to help them fight ISIS, they left us alone because they needed us to take care of ISIS because ISIS was a threat to them. As soon as the ISIS threat kind of went away, towards the latter part of 2018 and 2019, the Iranians started attacking Americans again. They just didn't anticipate that President Trump, when he drew a red line, it was going to be different than Obama's red line in Syria, because Trump said, if you kill one American, we'll come after you. And sure enough, they did. They tragically killed an American, you know, about a year ago, right before New Year's. And then from there, Trump struck back and we killed Qasem Soleimani. But a big problem, as good as that was, I think it was excellent that he did that. And that's the most vengeance that the U.S. has taken against Iran since 1979. We've played this game where Iran punches us and then we talk tough against Iran and we don't ever really punch back until we killed Soleimani. So I can't say enough good things about that. The problem is, once we did that, we remained in Iraq. Again, like, we're fighting the enemy on their terms. We have all the advantages in the world, economic and militarily, against Iran. But we leave these troops on the table in Iraq to give the Iraqi government money, who's really supporting Iran. It's I mean, I smile and laugh and think about it, but it's kind of sick. But we also give them this massive advantage. Like, we have these troops that are there on the battlefield that are vulnerable to all these different militant proxy groups that Iran has built up. So to me, there's nothing but strategic liability that comes out of being in Iraq, because really we're one Katyusha rocket away from killing an American. And then now Trump or the next president is faced with, okay, well, now what do I do? Now do I go to war for Iran because they just killed an American? Do I continue to pour money into the Iraqi government? When really we could just leave and do exactly what you just said, like say, hey, Iraq, like, call us if you want us back, but until you guys sever ties with Iran, like, we're not funding you anymore. Go ask Iran for money. And then we just sanction the crap out of Iran.
Right. And, you know, a lot of the people, from what I've been reading with some of the periodicals that are coming out of the Middle East, the Iraqi people are getting tired of, you know, the Iranian influence on all their lives over there. I think they want the Iranians out just as much as they want us out.
Yeah, I mean, they really do. And I think the Iraqi people actually want us to do a lot more. I mean, there was the convention of wisdom before he killed Soleimani and his deputy, who's an Iraqi-Iranian citizen, Abdulmadi Mohandas. The logic prior to that was that we couldn't touch these guys because they were so popular, and these guys were like rock stars, or they were like gods to, you know, folks in that area. After we killed them, like, the Iraqis and even a lot of people in Iran were like, well, thank God, like, hats off to President Trump for killing them. You know, like, I think Trump got more praise in Iraq from Iraqis than he did, you know, back here in the States, for making that decision. So I think you're right. And I've been reading the same thing. I think they want the Iranian influence out. And I think they would be able, I think if we didn't prop up that government and give them an option, they would have to bow to the whims of their people, because the problem is we continue to pump money in there because they say, oh, there's an ISIS threat and we're all scared of ISIS coming back. ISIS is bad. We don't want ISIS to come back. They say there's an ISIS threat, so we have to continue to give them aid. We don't want them to fail because we've lashed ourselves to them. Like, there's two administrations, and there's even members of the Trump administration who say that we need to be deeply invested in Iraq. So there's so many people right now that are deeply invested in making this government, despite all of its efforts, despite all that government's efforts to make it successful. So we just keep pouring money and enabling their horrible treatment of their people and their capitulation to Iran. We just keep enabling it with our money. I think it's time for us to walk away, probably not forever. To have an Iraqi government that is an ally to us would be great. Iraq is strategically valuable, but not at the cost that we're paying right now.
Just I'm strictly opinion. Do you think the Biden administration will pull us out, or do you think that we'll keep people there?
No, I mean, I think Biden, for a wide variety of reasons, he's going to have us stay in Iraq and in Afghanistan. I mean, he's ideologically wed to Iraq. This is another reason why, like, Trump, love him or hate him, the guy didn't have a record coming in, and that's a good thing, because he wasn't ideologically wed to past actions and past statements. I mean, Biden has voted for the Iraq war. Every opinion he's had on Iraq so far has called for more engagement, and frankly, every opinion he's had has been wrong. So these politicians especially career politicians that have been rewarded by failure, they don't tend to learn from their mistakes. They just double and triple down on it. And especially now that as polarized as things are, if you do the opposite of Trump, you must be good. So I think an easy win for Biden is to say, well, I'm just going to send more troops in because what Trump did was ridiculous. And now we're going to have more troops on the battlefield. The Iraqis are going to be like, oh, okay, well, Biden's back. We just need to tell him that ISIS is super bad and super scary, and the money will continue to flow in. And the same thing in Afghanistan, really. Like, we just need more time to build our army and our government. We just need more Americans here, and we need more money. And it's rinse, repeat. And I think Biden knows that most Americans don't closely follow these wars in the way that we do. I mean, the veteran community and the military community, like, we're pretty tiny in the grand scheme of things. So I think they'll just say that they're doing the opposite of Trump, and the media will, you know, reward them for that, and then we'll just move on. So I kind of have a more grim, pessimistic outlook on the next 4 years.
I think a lot of us have the same outlook. So what's next for you personally? I mean, I know you have two young sons. Are you going to continue to be involved with the, you know, some of the organizations that would like to see us end our involvement there, or, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. I'm working with Concerned Veterans for America right now. And that's our whole campaign is trying to end the endless wars. So as much engagement as they want me to do or they'll let me to do, I'm happy to do doing programs like this or even getting to go hopefully get in front of some of our congressional representatives and senators to convince them to use the tools of the legislature, namely the budget, to end these endless wars. In particular, I think repealing the National Defense Authorization Act of 2001. I mean, we've been essentially going to war on the same legal foundations since September 12th, 2001, as we are right now, which to me is kind of crazy. At some point, I think we need to review this and rein in the president's, whoever he happens to be, blank check on warfare. So that's something I'd like to work on as we move forward.
Yeah, I think on a future soft rep, either it might be just a question and answer type thing, or we might be doing another podcast. We were talking with the folks over there at Concerned Veterans for America, and maybe with yourself and getting another get together and talking about the issues here. But yeah,
I'd love to. Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely want to thank you for your time. We appreciate you taking the time. I know at Christmas time it's got to be very hectic with two young boys. And I remember that time. My son's now 22, so I'm a little bit older than you. But that Christmas time was a headache, but it was also the most fun as a parent.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but it's fun.
Yeah, because the kids' eyes are, when they light up like that, makes it all worthwhile. So,
yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, thank you for your time. We appreciate all your service and your continued service to our veterans community, as well as to, all the guys that are still serving there. So before we go, I just want to read something else before we sign off. You want to get SoftRep on your phone? Download our free mobile app and get easy access to our articles, podcasts, and gear reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to softrep.com to get access to all of our library of ebooks and our exclusive team room forums and content available on all your Apple and Android devices. We want to thank all our listeners out there for tuning in. We want to thank our guest, Joe Kent, who's, taking the time out of his Christmas holiday to join us. Joe, thanks again for joining us. We hope we can
thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, we hope we can do this again real soon.
Definitely.
And for myself, Steve Balistrieri, our guest Joe Kent, and all of us here at SoftRep.com, thanks for listening. We'll be back with another episode here real shortly.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid Kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch, so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.